The next case in the docket is 523-0331, Hudson versus Bassett.
Counsel, please introduce your name and firm so we know for the record.
Thank you. May it please the court. Your honors, my name is Adam Johnson. I represent the defendant appellant Jerry Basler, and I'm from the Lewis Brisbois Law Firm. There is one point before the court today, whether the jury verdict in the underlying case should be set aside on the grounds that it is irreconcilably inconsistent in that the jury awarded some medical bills but did not issue an award for pain and suffering or for loss of normal life. The court should reinstate the jury verdict because there were facts within the record that explain the jury's verdict, including that first, that plaintiff had only non-compensable pain and suffering. Second, that the jury had real questions as to the credibility of the plaintiff in testifying about his symptoms. And third, that there were numerous other unrelated conditions, including rheumatoid arthritis, carpal tunnel syndrome, multiple falls, and prior neck pain that could explain the jury's determination that the plaintiff did not have compensable neck pain or other compensable non-economic damages. The standard of review that applies to the point on appeal is de novo. I would refer the court to the Illinois Supreme Court case of Redmond v. Socha, which is referred to in the briefs. In that case, the standard of review was contested, and the Illinois Supreme Court held that because there is no discretion involved in determining whether a verdict is inconsistent, that the appropriate standard of review is de novo, and the trial court is in no better position than a court of review in assessing that issue. The Illinois Supreme Court repeated that conclusion that the appropriate standard of review is de novo more recently in 2022 in the McQueen case. The plaintiff cites and refers this court to case Hassard v. DS Realty for the proposition that the appropriate standard of review should be abuse of discretion. I would refer this court to paragraph 35 of the Hassard case, which states that the court reviews de novo a claim that a jury verdict is irreconcilably inconsistent. So we would ask that the court review the underlying trial court decision de novo. Turning to the merits of the dispute, the rules are clear for how this claim is reviewed, and that all reasonable inferences are resolved in favor of upholding the jury verdict. All disputed facts are resolved in favor of upholding that verdict. And then the court attempts to construct any reasonable hypothesis that would explain how the jury could have found what it found. In this case, as I said at the outset, there are numerous reasons that could explain the jury's decision to award some but not all medical bills, but not award any compensable pain and suffering and loss of normal life. There were multiple unrelated conditions that were the subject of expert testimony that Dr. Taylor said explained any pain symptoms that the plaintiff reported. The plaintiff complained of pain immediately before the accident, and Dr. Taylor testified that the symptoms that plaintiff reported after the accident were consistent with, if not identical, to the symptoms that she reported after the accident. Plaintiff's credibility was directly challenged early and often in the case. And in closing argument, we read a list of the inconsistencies and the problems with plaintiff's testimony, calling into question the veracity and credibility of the plaintiff on her subjective statements of pain. I would also note that this court in Snover, the seminal Illinois case, that court held that it is not necessarily inconsistent for a court or a jury to find that some pain-related expenses were awarded, but to find that the pain that the plaintiff may have experienced just didn't rise to the level of being something worthy of awarding money. In this case, I think that we should separate loss of normal life and pain and suffering. The analysis for minimal non-compensable pain relates to both of them, but there's another reason to sustain and uphold the jury's verdict for loss of normal life. The jury found, and defendant argued, that plaintiff, if she had an injury, it was for a very finite period of time, and the jury's award reflects that it agreed with that conclusion. The evidence at trial about loss of normal life was how plaintiff's life changed right now, the time of trial, whether she could walk her dog or play basketball when the case was going to trial. There was no evidence, or certainly no substantial evidence, about any activities that she missed out on in the weeks and months that represent the time period where the jury may have thought that she sustained any injury at all. So in addition to all the reasons why it's permissible for the jury to find that there was no compensable loss of normal life, during the time period where the jury actually thought the plaintiff may have had an injury, there simply wasn't any evidence that she had specific activities that she missed out on in terms of loss of normal life. That's one of the reasons, in closing, I directly asked the jury to award zero for a loss of normal life, because there simply wasn't evidence from which the jury could have found that plaintiff had compensable loss of normal life during that time period. Pain and suffering is a little bit different. The analysis is, I think, more complicated. I think the best way to approach it, in following the orders that are given in the Redmond case of constructing a reasonable hypothesis, is to compare the jury's award of medical bills against the medical bill list that the plaintiff asked the jury to award and that the jury took into its deliberations, which is plaintiff's exhibit C. Plaintiff asked the jury to award $100,000, and the jury ordered roughly half of that. But the reasonable hypothesis here, I think the most reasonable one, is that the jury more or less ordered those medical bills in chronological order, beginning with the date of the accident, and they thought that plaintiff recovered at some period of time. And if you compare the amount that the jury awarded against Exhibit C, the list of medical bills and the dates that they occurred on, what comes clear, at least to me, I think, is that the jury cut plaintiff off at the end of her physical therapy, and they notably left out some important bills that I think tell us a great deal about how the jury weighed the evidence. If you award the initial ER bill, the primary care visits after the accident, diagnostic care, physical therapy, and nothing else, you come up with just about exactly to the dollar the amount that the jury awarded. And that would take us from the time of the accident until March of 2020. But to make those work, then the jury would have excluded other records, which the jury had very good reason to exclude, and which tell us that the jury had serious questions about whether the plaintiff had any pain. The jury excluded a second ER bill a week after the accident that Dr. Taylor said was not related to the accident, not necessary. The jury excluded the bills of Dr. Bandekar, whose opinion the jury obviously discounted, given that Dr. Bandekar testified that plaintiff was going to have ongoing problems and need a surgery that the jury didn't award. And the jury certainly heard evidence that Dr. Bandekar gave 13 different diagnoses for Ms. Hudson, and at the time of trial didn't know what was wrong with her. So I think it makes sense, given that they rejected his opinions on causation and damages, that they didn't award his bills. But most importantly, I think, is the fact that the jury did not award pain injections in February of 2020. I think that is akin to a special interrogatory here. The numbers don't work.
How do you know they didn't?
We don't know, Judge, and there's no way to know. I think that's a fair point, but the legal standard is to create a reasonable hypothesis. By definition, that means that we have to look at what the jury awarded and the facts in front of the jury and try to come up with how the jury could have arrived at its decision. And there may be other ways to look at the evidence too, but removing the pain injections is entirely consistent with a determination that the plaintiff didn't have significant pain, or that the jury thought that any pain that plaintiff did have was caused not by the car accident, but by one of these other medical conditions that she was experiencing at the exact same time.
Was that argued to the jury?
It was the lack of pain argued to the jury, Judge?
That it could have been related to another cause.
Absolutely, Judge. And there was also evidence in front of the jury in the form of Dr. Taylor and Dr. Bandekar. Dr. Bandekar and Dr. Taylor both testified that plaintiff had specific objective signs of rheumatoid arthritis, including a particular subluxation in the cervical spine. That was Dr. Bandekar's, one of his current theories at the time of trial, that this had nothing to do with the accident, but it was caused by rheumatoid arthritis. And Dr. Taylor testified that plaintiff's symptoms were consistent with rheumatoid arthritis. So another condition that explained all of her pain that had nothing to do with the car accident. Dr. Taylor testified that Plaintiff had carpal tunnel syndrome, which he described as a very real condition and which had nothing to do with the car accident. It was argued through those experts and again at closing that one, plaintiff was not being straight with the jury about whether she had compensable pain, and two, that if she did have this pain, it was more likely coming from either one of these other comorbidities, the rheumatoid arthritis or the carpal tunnel syndrome that we know the plaintiff had and that we know were unrelated. In addition, it was argued that not only did plaintiff have nearly identical symptoms before the accident, but that she wasn't honest with us about those symptoms. She denied them in their deposition, which the jury can take into account both in considering that she had those symptoms and can weigh it against her credibility. And that also the jury can consider that this was a continuation of the same injury. That's the exact analysis that the Illinois Supreme Court took into account in the Snover case, where that plaintiff testified that she had very similar symptoms. And the court said, when there is that dispute, when we have these issues of conflict, these other conditions that are at play, when those things are contested, we only have one way to resolve those disputes. And that is to ask the jury, which one of these things do you think is causing the pain? And do you think that the pain is compensable?
That's not exactly what Snover said. The Snover case did not say that the jury is the only arbiter of the fact. It's talked about objective versus subjective symptomology, didn't it?
Well, Judge, that is part of the analysis. One of the things that the Snover court said that the trial court should do is understand the distinction between subjective symptomology and objective symptoms. It also contained language saying that we have to treat this as a practical matter and that only juries can tell us how much injuries are valued. And it called into question the credibility of the plaintiff in that case. One of the things that the Supreme Court specifically mentioned was that the credibility of the plaintiff was an issue in that case that needed to be resolved by the jury given the gap in treatment. So I'm sorry,
we're also supposed to give great deference to the trial court in this case who got to hear the witnesses and decide whether the verdict was consistent or inconsistent with the evidence. True?
Not true, Judge. I disagree with that because the standard of review, the standard of, excuse me.
We don't give deference to the trial court?
Do you review de novo the question in front of this court? That's the standard of review. I certainly think that you should respect Judge Goffinett, but I don't think you should defer in any way to Judge Goffinett's assessment of any of the evidence for this particular issue. To the extent the court does look to the determinations made by Judge Goffinett, I would tell you that the hearing transcript from the hearing on the post-judgment motion reveals that Judge Goffinett's assessment was that that he did not recall any of the evidence that we cited in our brief, that there were times where plaintiff experienced minimal pain. And that's just not consistent with the evidence in the record. And I would note that Judge Goffinett didn't have the benefit of a trial transcript at the time of that hearing. But there was substantial evidence that Ms. Hudson didn't experience any compensable pain and suffering. She testified on direct that she had severe symptoms, 10 out of 10 pain at times. And the jury heard records saying that she told Dr. Bandekar that when she overdid it, she had tingling and numbness and that her pain was on and off. And that physical therapy, she had good days and bad days. And those weren't things that Judge Goffinett considered. Instead, his assessment was,
isn't tingling an objective sign?
No, tingling is someone saying that they're experiencing a symptom. An objective sign.
Let me ask you about Stamp versus Sylvan. Doesn't that case say that it's important to keep in mind the presiding judge in passing upon the motion for a new trial has the benefit of his previous observation of the appearance of the witness, their manner in testifying, and of the circumstances aiding in the determination of credibility?
It does, Judge. And I think the important distinction between that case and this one is that the issue before the court in the Stamps case was a manifest weight challenge. So the judge is reviewed for abuse of discretion under that very different issue. But that's not the issue in front of the court today. Judge Goffinett had before him two issues. One, whether the verdict should be set aside as irreconcilably inconsistent, and two, whether the verdict was against the manifest weight. And you can see that in the lost wages portion of Judge Gaffinet's opinion. He first deals with inconsistency as lost wages and says they weren't inconsistent, and then moves on to manifest way. With the non-economic damages, pain and suffering and loss of normal life, that decision was made based on inconsistency. There was no review for manifest way. I would agree with you that if the ruling from the trial court had been that Judge Gaffinet thought the jury's award or lack of an award of non-economic damages was against the weight of the evidence, then there would be a different standard of review. That would be reviewed for an abuse of discretion, and the court would consider that Judge Gaffinet was in a different position than this court to do things like weigh the evidence. But I do think it would come out the same way. One of the things that I think is important is that in each of these cases, these $0 cases, where there is a dispute as to the credibility of the plaintiff, and when there is evidence of other causes, other traumas, other medical conditions, that in all of those cases, including in Snover and the DeFranco case, the reviewing courts have upheld the verdict because they have said that when there are those disputes created, it's for the jury to resolve. Justices, I see my time is over. I'll have the opportunity to discuss and rebuttal if there are no further questions.
No further questions.
No questions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Appley.
Good morning. May it please the court.
Mr. Johnson.
My name is Courtney Hughes. I'm with the Hughes Law Firm in Carbondale, and I represented Aaron Hudson at trial, and I'm going to argue on behalf of the appellee here this morning. I'd like to address 2 points, if I could, this morning. Briefly, the standard of review, since that's already been mentioned, and secondly, whether the trial court correctly determined that there was objective evidence of injury and pain and suffering justifying the new trial and damages. First, the standard review. In this particular case, we have an experienced trial judge, Judge Jeff Gaffinet of the Williamson County Circuit Court, who granted Aaron Hudson a new trial on damages, and this court ought to affirm Judge Gaffinet's order. Judge Gaffinet directed a finding of injury during this trial. I've tried over 100 jury trials, and I've been able to convince a trial judge to direct a finding of injury on less than 5 times. That's how convincing the evidence of injury was in this particular case. In this particular case, the jury awarded Aaron $72,000 in medical expenses. I filed a post-trial motion. We then had a hearing, and Judge Gaffinet, in his order, and that's found at C-1140 of the record, he basically indicated that the parties agree that the trial court was to determine if the verdict was inconsistent and or against the manifest weight of the evidence. And then he wrote in his order, he said, Mr. Hughes, on behalf of Aaron Hudson, says I should answer both those questions yes. Mr. Johnson, on behalf of Mr. Bazler, said I should answer both those questions no. And I believe what he did, a fair reading of the order, he sort of split the baby. He said, based upon my review of the evidence in this case, and he sat through every witness, read every evidence deposition, ruled on every evidence deposition objection, heard opening statement, heard closing arguments, directed a finding of injury, he determined that awarding $72,000 in past and future medical expenses to Aaron Hudson, based on the totality of the evidence that he heard, was inconsistent and not awarding her pain and suffering and or loss of normal life. But he then went on to address the lost wages in his order. He said that when I review the evidence on the lost wage claim, I find that the evidence of lost wage that the jury awarded zero for was not against the manifest weight of the evidence. So Mr. Hughes, you don't get a new trial on the lost wage claim. So he was reviewing the evidence from both an inconsistency aspect and also against the manifest weight of the evidence. Your Honors, I believe a fair reading of the order reveals that implicit in the order, the trial court determined that the jury's verdict of $0 for pain and suffering and $0 for loss of normal life was not only inconsistent, but also against the manifest weight of the evidence. Therefore, the standard of review is an abuse of discretion, not de novo. If a jury verdict is inconsistent, the trial court has no discretion but to order a new trial on damages. If the issue is a manifest weight of the evidence, then the standard of review of the appellate court is, again, abuse of discretion. I submit Judge Goffinette did not abuse his discretion. He sat in judgment of this case. He heard all the evidence. He accepted all the witness testimony. He ruled on all the objections, and he determined that this jury's award of $0 pain and suffering, loss of normal life, was against the manifest weight of the evidence. So let me address that if I could. Initially, Justice Cates mentioned the Stamp versus Sylvan case. That's found, by the way, at page 28 of my brief. Your Honors, I respectfully suggest that that case is directly on point, all four corners on point. In Stamp versus Sylvan, which, by the way, cited with authority this court's decision in Murray versus Philpott, which is a 1999 decision, new trial on damages. In Stamp versus Sylvan, that's a soft tissue injury case. There's no herniated disc, there's no pain injections in that case. Soft tissue injury case, 6 months of soft tissue injury treatment. The jury awarded the plaintiff in that case $4,348, but $0 for pain and suffering for 6 months of pain and suffering. And that went up on appeal, and the first district held that's an abuse of discretion. Clearly, the jury awarded the plaintiff over $4,000 for medical bills, which included treatment for pain and suffering, and yet awarded $0 for pain and suffering. New trial on damages. First District Stamp versus Sylvan. It's important to note when you read Mr. Basler's brief, and you just heard Mr. Johnson's argument, this argument is fiction. It's important to note the trial court never made a finding that the award of $72,000 in medical bills was for past medical treatment. The trial court never made a finding that the medical bills of $72,000 was only up to March of 2020.
Didn't the verdict form say past, day, and future?
Exactly. The itemized verdict form said past and future medical bills of $72,000. Judge, that was so important that Judge Goffinette specifically pointed that out in his order, that this fiction of Mr. Basler, that if you take Exhibit C, which is the plaintiff's medical bill exhibit, and what Mr. Basler is trying to do is, well, let's pick and choose, let's cherry pick what we think the medical bills were that the jury awarded, and then we will try and defend the verdict that way. Judge Goffinette correctly pointed out, you can't do that. The line item said past and future medical bills, $72,000. The line item said past and future physical pain and mental suffering, zero. The line item said past and future loss of normal life, $0. The trial court also never made a finding, and this is in Mr. Basler's brief, that the medical bill award was strictly for diagnostic care and not palliative care. In other words, testing care, not actually to make Erin Hudson feel better or to resolve her pain complaints. This is the fiction of Mr. Basler to try and defend the verdict. The trial court set that aside. In this case, Your Honors, if Mr. Basler wanted to test the jury's verdict, obviously before it was awarded, you would ask the jury for a special interrogatory. That wasn't done in this case. You would line item out past medical bills and future medical bills. That wasn't done in this particular case. The line item was past and future medical bills at $72,000. We're arguing here, oral argument. So let's accept the fiction, arguendo, that $72,000 was for past medical bills. And if we look at that fiction, we find out there's fallacy in it, in that if you do the math, which I actually did, and you add up the medical bills from the first ER visit Erin had to March of 2020, or last PT visit, that is, I'm not a mathematician, but I do have a calculator, $73,347.39. Mr. Basler says, well, wait, maybe the jury didn't award Aaron the second ER visit, which was $1,015.54. Are we at $72,000? No, we're not at $72,000 there either. The math doesn't add up. The evidence doesn't add up either. Almost devoid in Mr. Basler's brief and in oral argument this morning, there's two emergency room visits here. This woman was in a car accident. They said it wasn't the defendant's fault. He lost. They said that she was 50% or less at fault. They tagged her with 35% comparative fault. They said she wasn't injured. She got a $72,000 medical bill verdict. Now they say, well, she didn't suffer any pain and suffering. Let's test that. Is there any objective evidence that she had pain and suffering? She had two emergency room visits, the first one within 48 hours of the crash. I got that evidence in through their expert, Dr. Taylor. I cross-examined their expert, Dr. Taylor, on the emergency room treatment.
Was he an IME?
He was an IME. Actually, worse than that, Judge, it was a records review. He never even examined her. They just sent him 1,000 pages of her medical records, but included the ER visits. And what did he say? He said that Aaron's complaints of headache, pain, neck pain, and low back pain in the first emergency room visit were all car crash related. That's at C-136, 137 of the record. He testified that the ER physician's finding of muscle spasms in Aaron's neck in the ER was objective evidence of injury. That's at C-138, page 93, lines 16 to 17. He admitted that the emergency room's physician injection of Toradol into Aaron's body for her pain and his prescription of Valium in the emergency room were related to the car accident. Yet the jury awarded her $0 for pain and suffering. He deferred to the emergency room professional's note on that first ER visit where Aaron reported she had 8-9 out of 10 pain in the emergency room after the car accident. This is the first ER visit, yet the jury awarded zero for pain and suffering. She followed up with her primary care physician, Dr. Bryant. Dr. Bryant, first diagnosis and a consistent diagnosis throughout was neck pain. Neck pain. And she referred Aaron for physical therapy for neck pain. Yet the jury awarded $0 for pain and suffering. Aaron went to physical therapy at Heartland Regional Medical Center in Marion, Illinois, dozens of times. Tens of thousands of dollars in physical therapy, which Basler contends is part of the $72,000 verdict.
Is that the same hospital where she did the two ER visits?
Yes, sir. It is, correct. She had physical therapy there through March of 2020 on a July 2019 accident. She had treatment for her neck pain, range of motion, weakness, etc. Awarded by the jury under Basler's argument, yet $0 for pain and suffering. On 9-26-19, within 2 months of the crash, Aaron follows up with her primary care doctor. She's not getting any better. Dr. Bryant then orders what's called an MRI scan, very fancy x-ray of the neck to see if there's a disc injury or disc involvement. She orders the MRI because Aaron's still got neck pain. And then she orders Aaron to go to Dr. Bandekar. Who's Dr. Bandekar? He's a pain management expert and an orthopedic surgeon. She orders Aaron to go for pain management in the time frame that they say is covered by the medical bills, and yet the jury awards $0 for pain. She has the MRI. The MRI is then followed up with a visit with Dr. Bryant. And Dr. Bryant then refines her diagnosis to cervical disc disorder and an abnormality in Aaron's neck. That's at C14 of the record. Objective evidence of injury. Cervical disc disorder on an MRI scan, muscle spasms found by a medical professional in the emergency room, neck pain diagnosis after limited range of motion, from Dr. Bryant, physical therapy for months and months within the time frame they posit this court should accept, and yet $0 for pain and suffering. Irony, paradox. Mr. Bazar argues that the cervical epidural steroid injection costs were not covered by the jury verdict. Again, a fiction they come up with to try and defend the verdict. But let's say they're right, arguendo. The paradox and irony is the jury awarded Aaron medical bills for Dr. Bryant's history and physical approving of the injection, but then didn't award the injection bills? Doesn't make any sense. These are the facts that Judge Goffinette considered in the post-trial motion. He considered the fact that Dr. Taylor, the records review expert hired by the defense, literally told the jury that the palpable knots in Aaron's neck on September 18, 2019 were related to the crash in physical therapy. But then 7 days later, on September 25th, 2019, when she had the same palpable knots in her neck found by the same physical therapist, were not related to the crash because he had this arbitrary 8-week cutoff date for her injury. He said 8 weeks after the crash, she's done, she's cured, she's no medical bills are related to that, no injuries related to the crash. They argued in closing argument that the bills she should get were $14,866. I'll wrap up. I apologize. I got a little excited there. Your Honor, it's very simple. This is an abuse of discretion standard, and this is a case where Judge Goffinette sat in judgment of this case. He heard all the evidence, accepted all the testimony. In his good judgment, he determined that Aaron Hudson was entitled to a new trial and damages, and you should affirm that award or that order. Thank you.
Any questions, Judge?
No, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. May it please the court. Judges, on the standard of review issue, you know, I read Judge Goffinette's order differently about whether he reviewed for manifest weight. If he did, he cited the wrong law, because under Section A of his opinion, he cites the Redmond case for the applicable legal standard that he's applying to the question of whether the verdict is inconsistent. That is not a case about manifest weight. For the lost wages argument that I heard Mr. Hughes makes, the court does a two-part analysis. It has a paragraph on whether lost wages are inconsistent. It finds that it's not. And then there's a second different paragraph where the court reviews it for manifest weight and he finds lost wages aren't. He doesn't combine them into one mixed question of both of those points. He deals with them separately. So to me, the record is clear that that Judge Goffinette's ruling on non-economic damages was solely on inconsistency and that he didn't reach the issue of manifest weight. I heard mentioned this idea that it's unknowable what the medical bills were that the jury awarded, and we should consider that the verdict form included past and future medical bills, which it did, because that's what the IPI tells us that we're supposed to do. But I don't think it's a very reasonable hypothesis to think that the jury thought no medical care anywhere near the time of the accident was related, but $72,000 for a future surgery, which doesn't even match the cost of the future surgery, is all they related. So yes, I think there's a way that you can look at the medical bills and invent a reason why they don't make sense. It's just that's the opposite of the legal standard. The legal standard here is to construe those facts in a way that do make sense and explore whether there's a reasonable hypothesis. The medical bills that we explained, that I outlined originally, those come to $72,000, $388.85.
Would the slight impact have anything to do with the reasonable hypothesis?
I think so, Judge. And the way I think it comes into play is that it goes to credibility. Ms. Hudson asked for $750,000, and the jury saw time after time again the photos showing that there was no impact discernible on any of these vehicles.
And the jury also heard Mr. Hughes ask the doctors in evidence depositions, isn't it possible that a terrible violent crash can cause neck injury? And then they heard him get up an opening and say, no one's going to say this is a particularly violent impact. And then they heard my opening asking the jury to make note of the fact that when they listen to the evidence depositions, Mr. Hughes is going to characterize that impact with the doctors to get him to give the causation testimony very differently from what he just told you in opening statement. So I also think the fact that Ms. Hudson accepted no responsibility for causing the accident and the jury hit her for a third of the fault relates to that. So I think those facts relate to the nature, extent, and duration of the injury. The Peach case tells us that jurors are entitled to look at photographs and decide for themselves, irrespective of expert testimony, whether they think that the impact that occurred likely matches the symptoms that the plaintiff reported. I would take issue with this idea that the physical therapy awarded has to equal, you know, compensable pain and suffering and loss of normal life. I would refer the court to pages 58 and 59 of the supporting record. Dr. Bandekar says that the reason physical therapy was important for Ms. Hudson was for neck mobilization, for neck strengthening, and for relaxation techniques. That is not the same thing as saying that Ms. Hudson had terrible, violent pain, and only physical therapy could cure it. According to the spinal surgeon, the reason she was going there were for neck mobilization, for loss of range of motion, which is what Dr. Bryant found, slight reductions in range of motion in those initial visits. I would also take issue with the idea that there was objective evidence of injury or that Dr. Taylor conceded that. That's not at all what happened. Dr. Taylor said that the MRI that Mr. Hughes brought up showed no evidence of any impact or injury whatsoever. He also testified that a nerve conduction study, multiple nerve conduction studies, proved that Ms. Hudson didn't have any radicular symptoms or other injury caused by the accident, but they did prove that she had symptomatic carpal tunnel at the exact same time that was producing the symptoms that she saw here. Regarding the ER bills, you know, Dr. Taylor testified, I agree that this record represents that this physician is saying that they saw these things in these appointments. Dr. Taylor did not get up and testify, I agree that plaintiff had compensable pain and suffering. I agree that she had these objective symptoms or objective issues. The last thing I would say, judges, is that my time is up. I'd ask the court to reverse and reinstate the jury verdict, unless there are any questions from the panel.
I have no questions. Counsel, do you have any questions?
One question, Mr. Johnson, did the judge direct a finding of injury?
He did, Judge, and we oppose that on the record for the same reasons that we're stating here, that we think that that's evidence that the jury needed to consider. And I'll also note that the judge did.
My question, I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you, Judge.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay, case under advisement, issue a ruling in due course.